Dr. Albrecht, families and friends of the class of 2017, faculty and board members, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. and Mrs. Schneider lived across an air vent roof access space from my apartment, both our apartments being on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. These were very small apartments, ours and theirs. The apartments mirrored each other so that one could look from one kitchen into another kitchen directly. One spring day, a day very much like this, bright and beautiful, pleasant, when our mutual windows were open, Mrs. Schneider began preparing some of the most luscious pastries on earth. They're called rugola, a flaky Central European pastry. There was Mrs. Schneider rolling out the dough, putting in the walnuts and the sugar and the raisins and the cinnamon, rolling them up, situating them on a cookie sheet and slipping them into her green Wedgwood oven. That day, Mrs. Schneider was wearing a short-sleeved flowered dress in the 1950s style. At about 5 years old, I found myself mesmerized by the process. As I peered from my kitchen windowsill into her kitchen, pretty soon the smells began to waft across to my window. Mrs. Schneider, heretofore, who had not looked at me one time, finally, as the last tray was pulled out of the oven and placed on her windowsill, looked me directly in the eye, and she said, "You'll come, I'll give you to eat." So I scampered over my windowsill and made my way across to hers and held out my greedy little hands, over which she laid a napkin, and then proceeded to place the rugola in the napkin. It was as she was doing this that I noticed that there were a series of blue tattooed numbers going up her forearm. At 5 years old, I had no comprehension at all of the meaning or the significance of those numbers. And to be very honest and frank with you, I was more preoccupied by the warm rugola that I was holding in my hands. I took my treasures into my own kitchen and immediately hid them from my siblings, the Siricos having raised no dumb children. When my mom came in, I told her that Mrs. Schneider had given me some rugola, and then I asked her, almost as though I knew I should whisper it, why it was that Mrs. Schneider had numbers on her forearm. My mother's response was my first lesson in, what shall we call it, political philosophy, moral philosophy, anthropology. My mother simply said that Mr. and Mrs. Schneider had come for safety to the United States, that they had lived under a horrible government that had killed their family, and that they had come to America for refuge. Now, that was the first time that I knew what a refugee was. Prior to that, I thought refugees came from the land of refuge. As my father said, there are some Irish people who've moved into the neighborhood, some Puerto Ricans have moved into the neighborhood, some refugees have moved into the neighborhood, so I just thought they came from refuge. At 5 years old, I was astounded and aghast that human beings could treat other human beings in this manner. My mother deepened the lesson by asking me, what kinds of movies do you watch on Saturday mornings? And I said, Westerns. And she said, what do the cowboys do with the calves that they catch? I said, they tie them up and then they brand them. She said, why do they brand them? And I answered, so that everyone will know whose calf that is. She explained to me that that was the way that some people treated Mr. and Mrs. Schneider. That simple explanation revealed to me the very foundation of the natural law. In the eighth psalm, the psalmist asks a question that lingers in each human heart. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? Who are we? Why are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? Why does evil exist in this world? These are the perennial questions that occupy every human heart without regard to our particular religious affiliation. We find these questions reverberating down through the millennia in Confucius, in Lao Tse, in the Buddha, in Homer. We find these questions naturally embedded in the human heart. And how we answer these questions will determine the course of the rest of our lives. It will determine the kind of society that you will choose to build, the kind of civilization that you will contribute in constructing. If you believe that the human person is simply the accidental and random combination of only material parts, formed by no particular rationality or purpose, you will tend to treat others according to that assumption and build institutions upon that assumption. You will treat others as mere material objects, objects very often to be manipulated for your own utility, for your own convenience, for your own benefit. Always thus treated, of course, with the very best of intentions. But if you believe that each and every individual human being whom you encounter is, as C.S. Lewis says, either an eternal splendor or an everlasting horror, an immortal being with an origin deeper than this world and a destiny beyond it, then I suggest that you will tend to treat people in a far more sober-minded, indeed reverential manner, recognizing in others, Lewis again, that the most sacred thing that presents itself to our senses next to the Blessed Sacrament itself is our neighbor. Your approach to them will be as encountering the sacred because you recognize the sacred in yourself. Above the portal at the temple in Delphi is inscribed the admonition, "Know thyself." Who are you? This is the first question. The process that you have just undergone in these last few years, the process of education and formation, is predicated on an assumption that, oddly enough, is not shared by everyone. And it will not be shared by some of those in those contexts to which you are about to proceed in the next few years. It is an idea that presumes that your minds are suitable and capable and designed to pursue the truth of things. Now, that seems almost axiomatic, doesn't it? I mean, what else would you do with your mind except to attempt to apprehend the truth of a thing, whether it's a piece of literature or an experiment or a work of art or a piece of music or just a good meal? We inquire because we are knowing beings. And not to inquire is, as Socrates taught us, to live a life not worth living. We seek to know the truth of things. We have the capacity to self-reflect. And this is not just to reflect on things outside of us, but to reflect upon ourselves as well, which makes us the most unique of all creatures on earth. Unlike animals, we have the capacity to reflect upon our reflection. This process that you've just undergone is also designed to inoculate you. To inoculate you against a rampant, powerful, seductive alternative to itself. Evasion. You will encounter it. You are unable to avoid it. I speak here of a moral relativism. It is an epistemological agnosticism that denies the capacity of the human mind to know the truth. this concept that presents itself as the very apex of tolerance is really incoherent. It is self-contradictory. And because of it, it is dangerous, because it descends into what Pope Benedict once called the dictatorship of relativism. It is seductive because it invites us to have the posture of knowledge without the obligation that truth imposes upon us. It is tempting because it makes no arduous personal demands of us, because after all, everything is relative. So that if you just understand something well enough, you can justify anything. After all, according to this line of reasoning, evil doesn't really exist. Evil is simply the name that we give to things we don't understand. The question that was posed by Pilate to Jesus 2,000 years ago was presented, I imagine, with a cynical sneer. What is truth? What is truth? Actually, it was an evasive maneuver to avoid the responsibility for the judgment that Pilate was about to make. But there are modern Pilates today, especially those who occupy the numerous endowed, often government-endowed chairs in our prestigious universities, who ask the same questions with the same cynical tone. The question is posed not to seek an answer, which is why you usually pose a question, but is posed because they don't believe there are ultimate answers to fundamental questions. The posing of the question is merely to evade the responsibility that an authoritative answer would impose upon the human heart. Our tradition, the Western tradition, Western civilization, is based upon a particular anthropology that we find in the Old and New Testaments. It is called the Judeo-Christian tradition, and rightly so. And this civilization, which is predicated on the assumptions we find in the scriptures, has enabled our world to see the construction of the most free and properly understood, the most liberal society and prosperous civilization that the world has ever known. You and I have hit the lotto. We live in the midst of this, and we are its beneficiaries, and in fact live on the higher end of it. And yet these very ideas which have formed the pillars of liberty, of this high anthropology, if you will, are under great threat. They are threatened because of the kind of anthropological vision that I've just painted for you, the challenge of moral relativism. Our tradition begins with an anthropology that sees human life itself as sacred. Each individual human life is sacred, and human beings possess an inherent right to keep their lives. This is not because society or a government or even a family or a set of laws has granted these rights to them, but because by the very nature of the case, humans possess these rights in themselves. It is what the Declaration of Independence described as a self-evident truth. That is to say, it needs no proof, because were you able to disprove it, you would disprove the very person who is making the assertion that it is untrue. This anthropology, in turn, enables us to understand that not only does the human person possess the right to his life, but also has the right to what he produces in the course of that life, in the exercise of his intelligence. That is to say, private property in this tradition is also seen as sacred because of its intimate connection to man. Hence the commandment, thou shalt not steal. And as a result of believing not only in the dignity of the human person, not only in his right to life, not only in his right to his property, but also because of all of that, in the right to engage in contracts with others, so that the right of contracts, and thus the necessity of courts to enforce and adjudicate disputes among people peacefully, all of these things, initially abstract ideas, will come to form a very concrete set of institutions that have protected and prospered the human family. These ideas stem, in the first place, from certain basic assumptions which you will have to confront and which you will see under brutal attack. To make a distinction, as we have in our tradition, between authority and power, is likewise one aspect of this inheritance. Think how important it is to make a distinction between authority and power. We almost use those words interchangeably, don't we? The sociologist Robert Nisbet, from whom I'm drawing this distinction, really helps us to see how critical it is. Authority, he says, and power are both forms of constraint. They constrain our activity. But authority is an interior form of constraint, whereas power is external. Authority is the acquiescence to mores and traditions, to institutions, to religious ideas that we ourselves believe in, that we adopt and hold on to, that we obey. Power is external to us. Its essential nature is that it can coerce us, it can force us to perform actions or conscribe our liberty. Both of these are forms of constraint. But woe to that society that too much depends upon power and not enough upon authority. Not enough on the traditions which people hold by an agreed consensus, whereby they freely restrict their behavior out of a conformity to a law or a custom or a habit or more that they believe in themselves. Woe to that society that eviscerates tradition and allows power to accrue and to grow, for under such systems we have the kind of regimes that give us millions upon millions of Mr. and Mrs. Schneiders. As you go forth, beware of the seductive calls to a false tolerance. The claim that if you hold and assert a truth that runs against the political conoscenti in our societies, beliefs that you hold that are politically incorrect, that these make you intolerant. The most horrible accusation that can be issued against another person in the modern context, the thing that people, moderns, most dread hearing, is that you are intolerant. It is a lie. It is a smokescreen. You are called, like Toto, to pull aside the drapes so you can see the little weak man operating the big make-believe machinery. True tolerance, my friends, necessitates a belief in the truth of things. You are not tolerant when you have to accept or endorse things with which you do not agree. It is the tolerance of them, it is the putting up with such things, that makes you tolerant. Those who cried for tolerance in a previous generation are the very ones who today are the most intolerant if you disagree with them. Don't buy into the false notion of tolerance that is really a backdoor way of getting moral relativism accepted. As you go forth, beware of such seductive calls to compromise your confidence in your mind's ability to apprehend the truth and in your will's ability to live the truth. This is the core of the moral life, that you have a free will, that you can choose to live the truth, even though sometimes it may be difficult or may even cost you your life. Do not settle for mediocrity in your moral lives or in your professional engagements. Have the same respect for others that you know you have the right to accept yourself. Do not succumb to the ideologies that would seek to reduce liberty to license or to expand the sphere of power, reducing human beings to objects, indeed slaves. I chose the name of Lord Acton as a kind of icon for the Institute that I was honored 27 years ago to found with my best friend, Chris Mowren. We chose that name because Acton is known as the historian of liberty. He sought the construction of a society that was both free and virtuous, because he understood that virtue was the only glue that could keep a free society together. As I close these remarks, I want to leave you with two considerations from Lord Acton, which I want you to think about in the days ahead. Lord Acton once made the observation that liberty is the delicate fruit of a mature civilization. You, ladies and gentlemen, are the inheritors of a great and august legacy. The fact is that you did not invent this, nor did you create it. You are merely its inheritors, and inheritors with an obligation to preserve and even hand on this legacy. You and I are the descendants of those who have, in some cases, fought with their very lives to defend freedom. Lord Acton offers us another keen insight when he wrote that liberty, that liberty of which we speak, is not the freedom to do what we want, but the liberty to do what we ought. In the great liberty that this country guarantees by its Constitution, we must understand that our freedom can only be exercised responsibly when it is in conjunction with the truth, beginning with the truth of who you are and culminating in the truth of who Jesus Christ is. For only in that way can we guarantee the rights of all peoples, the vulnerable, the poor, the unborn, the ignorant, the marginalized, the dejected, and even those in error. I pray that you will take for yourselves this moral orientation to the liberty that you will have the privilege to live. Thank you very much.